This is an ABC podcast.
Imagine going to the doctor with an infection, expecting a simple fix like a dose of antibiotics, and then walking out empty-handed because the hospital doesn't have any available. It's a common scene around the Pacific, where medicine shortages have been a problem for decades, and it's a reality that's hit close to home for Emmanuel Marshall when he took his grandfather to a hospital in Fiji.
It came to a point where he was admitted where he got blood poisoning, which is termed as septicemia, in the hospital. Basically, basic medicines such as morphine and those stuff were not available.
From painkillers to life-saving drugs, even the most basic medicines are running out. And in Fiji, as this crisis worsens, the country's doctors are reaching their breaking point.
Facilities were out of normal saline. We've got bandages out of stock. We've got a paracetamol out of stock, some basic antibiotics, some penicillins out of stock. So the prescription now has to be given to the patient to go ahead and purchase it from outside.
But why is this happening? And more importantly, what does it mean for people who rely on them? Hi, I'm Scott Whiteay, and this is Polytalk, where I'll take you behind the scenes of Pacific politics and how it affects us. I'll speak with politicians from across the Pacific region and with everyday people about the political experiences that shape us. Today on Polytalk, the politics behind a health crisis gripping the region. And you'll hear from Fijian patients and the president of Fiji's Medical Association about just how bad the medicine shortage has become.
Our health staff are starting to cut corners. They start to compromise care when we have these shortages.
And I'll speak with Sir Colin Tukuitonga, one of the region's leading Pacific health experts, about how Pacific governments get their medicines into countries and where it's all gone wrong.
The problem for many islands is that these days their main issues are diabetes, heart disease, gout, those kinds of what we call chronic conditions. They don't go away. So the treatment plans are not to cure them. The treatment is to reduce the likelihood of complications or postpone complications and keep people well. And that's an expensive business.
Emmanuel Marshall studied medicine at Fiji National University and is now a lab technician living in New Zealand. And in January 2025, he had to quickly fly back to Fiji when his grandfather fell extremely sick.
It hurt me a lot to see the type of healthcare that he had in Fiji. It hurt me because I flew over to Fiji and he was admitted at hospital. And the state of the hospital was something that I would never wish on anyone.
Emmanuel, what happened when you took your grandfather to hospital?
It came to a point where he was admitted where he got blood poisoning, which is termed as septicemia, in the hospital, and he needed antibiotics for that. And that was not available at the time, which was needed for him. And the answer we got was that it's not available at the warehouse, so we were asked to buy it privately. And I was fortunate enough to be able to afford that antibiotics because it cost me close to around $500 a vial, which he needed to have every 8 hours infused in him. And he needed to have it for 14 days. So you could imagine the amount of money it cost me. And good enough for me, I'm able to afford it. But I felt sorry for the patients next to him. It came to a point in time where the nurses came around on a ward run and asked me, excuse me, sir, do you have any extra? And then I asked why. And they said, there's a baby in pediatrics that needs it. And it was just sad to be in that kind of state, really.
How did your grandfather feel about the fact that the hospital didn't have antibiotics for him?
My grandfather felt he just wanted to die, really. He told me honestly that, don't waste your money on me. I want to die. It's not something here that he'd like to for me to do. But I would move heaven and earth for him, because basically he was very close to me. He raised me up and I did it for him, really. But it's not fair. In that situation, to me as a medical person, that type of circumstance is not fair on the patients at all. It's not acceptable in healthcare, really.
Emmanuel, you're working now in New Zealand as a lab technician, but before this, you studied medicine in Fiji and you worked as a laboratory scientist in Fiji. From your perspective, how has medicine shortages impacted people across your career?
At the time, while I was a student, I basically did do some practical and attachment training at the hospital. However, it did not hit me as much as when I started work. When I did get employed, that's when it hit me hard. In my experience and observation, the issue of around medicine and stuff is actually a systemic issue, because it's not just medicine that is short in Fiji. It's basically testing capability and capacity within Fiji. Fiji is very fortunate to have very qualified and skilled personnel working in healthcare. However, these personnel are not giving the right tools. They're not giving the right equipment. They don't have even blood pressure monitors. They're all broken. Equipment that they use are not calibrated. Blood testing reagents is not available. However, these people, if you give them the equipment, they will do a very good service. And something in my observation as well is that there are a lot of these professional people leaving Fiji at the same time, because they simply are looking for greener pastures and opportunities. And it's a problem as well. When I look back basically at Fiji, I feel very sad. I feel very sorry. And I always advocate to the staff or the medical personnel people that are working there. I thank them and acknowledge them for the hard work. However, I do remind them that it's not fair for the patients to be having this type of treatment at all.
And how do your friends, family, and community feel about this?
When I talk to people back in Fiji and I do a bit of talks and chats with them, they basically state that they've lost faith in the medical system in Fiji. They do not trust it. There's no confidence for them to visit health centers when they do get sick, and they would rather resort to medical treatment and other types of treatment, because the public health system in Fiji for them is basically questionable to them. They've lost confidence in the health system in Fiji, which is quite understandable. But it's not their fault that they feel that way, really.
Emmanuel paints a dire picture and reveals the big divide in Fiji's healthcare system. Emmanuel took his grandfather to a public hospital for treatment. And that hospital, like many other public hospitals in Fiji, did not have antibiotics. But he was able to buy the required medicine out of his own pocket from a private pharmacy. Emmanuel and his grandfather were in an urban area. But in more remote parts of Fiji, it's even worse. Cecilia and her husband live in a small village without a public health clinic. When Cecilia's husband cut his leg, they set off to get it treated.
My husband had a sore. It was a scratch, and he kept scratching, so it had become an ulcer. So we all went down to the hospital. Yes, so that's the one right down the highway. So we all went in to the doctor. I went with my husband. So when we went to the nurse, you know, to bandage, I asked the nurse if she could give some spare bandages, and because it's quite a distance, and it's $60 going and return, a return trip to the hospital, to that health center and back. Because the doctor, there's one close by, but it's just the nurse that's there. So we wanted to see the doctor. And the nurse said, oh, I'm sorry, we are really short of bandages. And now this is the only thing I can do. I can just bandage it here. But you'll have to buy your own bandages. I mean, I said, well, it's really far from here to there. Would you just give me just for a few days? But, you know, she was really said, if I'll give away this, we might run short.
So what did you have to do?
I have to use a safe pad, sanitary pad, till we'll go down to town. Then we can buy fresh supplies of what we need for his wound. I really would like to see changes, especially when you are living out in the interior like us.
So my full name is Dr. Alipate Vakamudea. I'm currently the president of the Fiji Medical Association. Everybody just calls me Dr. Pate.
Dr. Pate, how bad is the medicine supply for Fiji's public medical system at the moment?
So like when you talk to the doctors on the ground and you ask them, what are the three things that are keeping you up at night? They give us three answers, not necessarily in this order. So one is infrastructure, which the current government is addressing. Two is HR, so the lack of nurses, because countries like Australia and New Zealand like to steal our nurses. And the third one is consumable and medicine supply. So this is top three on any doctor's mind in Fiji at the moment. We've noticed it for quite some time. Now, to put things into perspective, if you read an annual report from the Ministry of Health in the early 2000s, say 2004, 2005, it will highlight some of the out-of-stock medications in the Ministry of Health, and it would be something like 50 or 60 medications. Today, in 2025, we're talking hundreds, maybe in the area of like 400 or 500 different types of medications. But the worry here is medications are divided up into a few categories. You have the critical ones, the ones that are absolutely needed for survival, basically. So those are like your adrenalines and things like that. And we've got out of stock of both critical and essential. Critical, essential, and non-essential medications. It's across the board. And the interesting thing here is that you will see this in the public hospitals, but not in the private hospitals, not in the health centers, and not in the pharmacies.
How reliant is Fiji's population on the country's public health system?
So the majority of the healthcare system in Fiji is public. We've got over 200 facilities, which are both they range from different levels, from nursing stations to health centers to subdivisional hospitals to tertiary hospitals and specialist hospitals. So the majority of the healthcare system in Fiji is public. And the majority of Fijians, so well over half of the population, so you're looking at something like 700,000 to 800,000 people, would be reliant on the public hospital system, the public healthcare system.
And what does this mean for patients who need basic medicines that the public health system can't provide?
So like, for example, it's reached the state where we've got very, very senior clinicians, in fact, clinicians who taught me when I was in medical school, saying that they've never come across this situation before where they have to prescribe IV fluids and give it to the patient to go to the pharmacy and purchase the IV fluids, because the Ministry of Health facilities were out of normal saline. We've got bandages out of stock. We've got a paracetamol out of stock, some basic antibiotics, some penicillins out of stock. So the prescription now has to be given to the patient to go ahead and purchase it from outside.
How is this affecting doctors and hospital staff in Fiji?
Well, we're getting feedback from our members in that they're feeling very handicapped almost because of the shortage of medications and medical consumables. They are unable to carry out their duties to a standard that any healthcare system would be comfortable with, and they've had to cut many corners, and obviously once you start cutting corners in health, you start to breach patient safety and quality care. So they've written to us. They've expressed their concerns that they are unable to provide a quality healthcare standard to the average Fijian, because if you can afford it, then we'll get it for you. It's reaching that sort of levels. In our intensive care unit at our major hospital here in Suva, we had the ICU staff having to treat somebody with in sepsis. So it's like their body goes into shock. And one of the things you need to give is you need to load them up with lots and lots of IV fluids. And because our IV fluids were out of stock, basically, usually you'd see in the movies, you'll see the 1 liter ones running. So this one, what was being distributed was like a 500 ml little bottle that they would have to squeeze, and you know, once it runs out, then they add another one. And so it was quite distressing on not just the health staff but also the families to have to watch their loved ones be treated like that.
This is not a recent crisis. For decades, Fiji and across the Pacific, there's been the persistent issue of medicine shortages. What are the long-term effects that you've seen from this?
Our health staff are starting to cut corners, they start to compromise care when we have these shortages. Like, for example, if you know that a particular bacteria is causing a particular infection and you don't have access to that medication, then you would obviously order something a bit stronger. So you're giving somebody a medication that's a lot more potent than what they should be getting because you don't have it. You're doing a couple of things. Number one is you're causing unnecessary side effects to the patient. But number two is, like, especially if it's an antibiotic, you're basically contributing to the antibiotic resistance. So if that person gets infected the next time, then that particular medication might not work, and then you'll have to go for another more expensive one. So, like, it's those sorts of issues that we're going to start to see later on in the future, the rise of antibiotic resistance. But the other issue, and this one comes from a patient safety and quality standard, is when you start cutting corners, and if you've cut them for so long, eventually you start to forget what the normal should be, and you start to accept the abnormal as normal. And once we start to find the health system in that state, we get into trouble. Because, you know, when everything returns back to normal, we don't improve again. We don't fix those corners.
Polytalk has reached out to Fiji's Ministry of Health on this issue, but we haven't received a response. However, local media, the Fiji Times, reported in March 2025 that Fiji's Prime Minister, Sitiveni Rambuka, has expressed concerns around the medicine shortage and said that his government is committed to strengthening the healthcare system, and that a newly opened warehouse funded by the Japanese government will help with the medicine distribution. The medicine shortage is a crisis for Fiji, which is alarming for the rest of the Pacific, because Fiji is one of the most well-funded public health systems in the Pacific, spending just over 5% of its gross domestic product, or GDP, on health. By comparison, Solomon Islands spends 4.7% of its GDP on health, and PNG spends only 2% on health. And so the medicine shortage crisis isn't just isolated to Fiji. It's an issue affecting most Pacific countries, where public systems consistently run short of basic medicines, like paracetamol that can help with fevers, to critical medicines like morphine and antibiotics that can save lives. So why does this problem persist? Dr. Colin Tukuitonga is one of the Pacific's leading public health experts who has studied health systems across the region.
Well, I guess the problem persists for a number of reasons. One is pharmaceuticals are expensive. And even in Australia, New Zealand, developed nations, pharmaceutical budgets is among the highest component of the health sector. So it's an expensive business. The second is, of course, it's more expensive in smaller islands where the volume, their needs are much smaller. In other words, there is power in bulk purchasing that is often not possible for small islands with small budgets. Although they have tried the collective bulk purchasing arrangement, I think in the 80s, they, with Australian, New Zealand money, they built a pharmaceutical warehouse in Fiji that was meant to service all the small island nations. But it turned out that some of the members didn't pay their bills, and Fiji got annoyed and predictably said, we're not doing this. These medicines have a health, a certain shelf life, and you've got to have really switched on stock management provisions. Some need cool storage and cool facilities, not always possible in small islands. So multiple complex challenges, I guess, and no wonder we continue to have problems with medication shortages on an ongoing basis.
Can you explain the process of how Pacific governments buy medicine and get them into their countries?
In the old days, in the good old days or the bad old days, the World Health Organization had a thing called the Essential Medicines List. As you can imagine, there's a whole lot of medicines for different things, you know, from weight loss to antibiotics and so on. And not all countries are able to buy all of the things that are available in the market. And so WHO and a number of the regional agencies encourage small island states to define 15, 20, 25 of the so-called essential medicines, the medicines that you need most for most of the problems for most of your people in your country. The idea was you can't afford to buy everything, so you should decide which of these are your top 20 requirements. That's the first thing. Each country decide what are the medicines that they need for their people. Inevitably, the list is always more demanding. It's like someone going shopping. You always want more things than your budget allows you. It's a bit like that. And so they are forced into choosing their top 20 or whatever. Once that's done, obviously, they have to budget for it every year. And a number of small island states rely on development money, DFAT money, New Zealand money, WHO, and so on, to buy the medicines because their own budget is not up to it. Generally, not a good idea because you're always then relying on someone else paying for your weekly shopping. And so the encouragement was that each country should really pay for their own medications, but as we discussed earlier, it's not always possible for them to buy all of the things that they need and constantly run out. That's one issue, not enough money. The second issue is procurement, if big word for buying what you need, is a complicated process. You want to shop around for the best deal that you can get, and you want to be assured that you, when there's a global shortage, you don't get push to the back of the queue, all of that kind of stuff. So procurement is an issue. And not all island states have the skills, the resources, and the people with the smarts to manage stock, to make sure that all stock is used first and there's a constant supply.
And once it's been purchased, how does that medicine get to the cities and villages?
Shipping and air freight through the islands, big deal. Unreliable, irregular, expensive. And so the supply chain, as it's called, is then challenged because, as I say, shipping, the ship doesn't always sail when it's meant to sail and all of that. And constantly they run out. And if you are not in the capital city and you're in one of the outer villages or the small islands, you are at a even worse because you shipping from the capital to the outer islands, again, is a difficult business in many islands. And so they don't always get the supply they need. And as I say, for some of these things, particularly insulin, for example, not only there's a supply problem globally, but you've got to chill it. You've got to make sure that you have cool facilities to store it. And, you know, that's not always possible. So it's a very long, complicated process from the maker of the medicine to the user at the other end, particularly in rural and outer islands in the Pacific region.
The key issues you've outlined with the issue of medicine shortages are the reliability of the process of buying medicines and then the cost of the medicine itself, all things the politicians in charge of this know about. From your perspective, why haven't Pacific governments been able to fix this?
Public health is what we call the long game. We're playing the long game, keeping people well, preventing disease, stopping them from smoking, improving diet. You know, boring stuff for many people that takes time. You don't change people's attitudes overnight. In other words, it's a very long game. Politicians, particularly ministers of health, get into their appointment 3 years, 4 years if they're lucky, and move on. Many of them come into the role clearly uninformed, don't know the issues. And so they don't really understand the complexity of these things and what's going to make the difference for health. But then they're often not, like our lot here, they have their own promises that they've made to their sponsors. And, you know, they're not, someone told me the problem with us in public health is we got to make things more urgent. If politicians don't have to address anything in the short term, they'll kick it down the road and hope someone else will pick it up. That's the problem. The political cycle is too short and it's not aligned with the long-term objectives of public health and treatments and so on. That's often the challenge. Less of an issue in developed nations, I suppose, because there's a general awareness and people will share the commitments. They might have different priorities depending on the color government they are. But in developing countries, it's more stark. If someone would promise to make some particular drug available, the next guy comes along and stops it. So that's the problem with the non-alignment of the political cycles with the public health cycles.
And when it comes to the illness and disease we see in the Pacific most commonly, how does this medicine shortage impact that?
Problem for many islands is that these days their main issues are diabetes, heart disease, gout, those kinds of what we call chronic conditions. They don't go away. So the treatment plans are not to cure them. The treatment is to reduce the likelihood of complications or postpone complications and keep people well. And that's an expensive business. In the bad old days, of course, when infectious diseases was the go, you either got cured or fixed and sorted, or you died. In other words, it's not a pleasant way to describe things, but it's not what we see these days. So 3/4 of all of the deaths in the islands these days are due to diabetes, obesity, heart disease, and so on. And many of these people, many of the patients live with these conditions that require daily medication. And daily medication is expensive business.
How do you feel when you look at the state of medicine shortages around the Pacific?
I've been at this game 40 years. It'll tell you how old I am. And it just annoys me that people, particularly kids, young people, born into circumstances is not of their making when they need something that will benefit them and can't get it. That really annoys me. We have insulin available, and we know it's effective, highly effective. And if this young person gets regular supply of insulin, they can expect to have a near normal life expectancy. And yet many young people, many people in the islands don't get that opportunity because their governments can't afford it and their families can't afford it. That's the unfairness of it all. And I often talk about people in wealthy countries and wealthy people broadly have too much medicine. They take medicines that cost a lot that they don't need. And the people, particularly young people in developing countries and island nations, who do need them, who will benefit from these medicines, often don't get it. That's the unfairness of it all. That's the inequities in our health systems.
The medicine shortage crisis in the Pacific isn't just a policy failure. It's a human crisis. It's patients like Emmanuel's grandfather, doctors like Dr. Pate, and families like Cecilia's who are forced to make impossible choices. Without urgent action, the cycle continues. Hospitals without medicine, doctors cutting corners, and patience paying the price. Polytalk is hosted by me, Scott Wyde. Our producer is Kuntamari Crofts. Our supervising producer is Jordan Fennell. And our executive producer is Faleanga Fulu, Inga Stunzner.